always does that when I'm there, I think to show me off in a way, even though if it had been up to her, I'd never have left the island, and I'd be driving my father's snowplow. Awkward to be thrown into a room together, but wonderful to see you again, and to talk to you a little after all this time. 4 kids, I can't imagine. It's been years since I've written to anyone, actually, not just you, and I confess I'm out of practice. But I have news, big news, and when it happened, you were the first one I wanted to tell. I'm getting married. It's very sudden. I didn't mention it at Christmas because I wasn't sure yet, but now I am, and it seems perfectly right. Her name's Miranda, and she's actually from the island, but we met in Toronto. She's an artist who draws strange, beautiful comic strip-type things. She's moving to L.A. with me next month. How did we get so old, V? I remember building forts with you in the woods when we were 5. Can we be friends again? I've missed you terribly. A. Dear V, strange days. The feeling that one's life resembles a movie. I have such disorientation, V, I can't tell you. At unexpected moments, find myself thinking, how did I get here? How have I landed in this life? Because it seems like an improbable outcome when I look back at the sequence of events. I know dozens of actors more talented than me who never made it. I've met someone and fallen in love. Elizabeth. She has such grace, beauty, but far more important than that, a kind of lightness that I didn't realize I'd been missing. She takes classes in art history when she isn't modeling or shooting films. I know it's questionable, V. I think Clark knows. Dinner party last night. Very awkward and ill-advised in retrospect. Long story. Seemed like good idea at time. And I looked up at one point, and he was giving me this look, like I disappointed him personally. And I realized he's right to be disappointed. I disappoint myself, too. I don't know, V. All is in turmoil. Yours, A. Dear V, Clark came over for dinner last night, first time in 6 months or so. Was nervous about seeing him, partly because I find him less interesting now than I did when we were both 19. Unkind of me to admit, but can't we be honest about how people change? Also, partly because last time he was here I was still married to Miranda, and Elizabeth was just another dinner guest. But Elizabeth cooked roast chicken and did her best impression of a 1950s housewife, and he was taken with her, I think. She kept up her brightest veneer through the whole evening, was completely charming, etc. For once, she didn't drink too much. Do you remember that English teacher we had in high school who was crazy about Yeats? His enthusiasm sort of rubbed off on you, and I remember for a while you had a quote taped to your bedroom wall in the lake house, and lately I've been thinking about it. Love is like the lion's tooth. Yours, A. Chapter 26. Please tell me you're joking, Clark said when Elizabeth Colton called to tell him about the book. Elizabeth wasn't joking. She hadn't seen the book yet, it wouldn't be released for another week, but she'd been told by a reliable source that both of them were in it. She was furious. She was considering litigation, but she wasn't sure who to sue. The publisher? V? She'd decided she couldn't reasonably sue Arthur, as much as she'd like to, because he apparently hadn't known about the book either. "What does he say about us?" Clark asked. "I don't know," Elizabeth said. "But apparently he talks about his marriages and friendships in detail. The word my friend used was unsparing."
"Unsparing," Clark said. "That could mean anything." But probably nothing good, he decided. No one's ever described as being unsparingly kind.
He liked to describe the people in his life, apparently. At least he had the grace to be upset about it when I called him. A fizz of static on the line. "It's called Dear B?" Clark was writing this down. This was 3 weeks before the pandemic. They still had the indescribable luxury of being concerned about a book of published letters. "Dear V, she's his friend Victoria."
"Former friend, I'd imagine."
"I'll call him tomorrow," Clark said. "He'll just start rambling and deflecting and obfuscating," she said.
Or maybe that's just how he talks to me. Do you ever talk to him and get the sense that he's acting?
I actually have to run, Clark said. I've got an 11 a.m. interview.
I'm coming to New York soon. Maybe we should meet and discuss this.
Okay, fine. He hadn't seen her in years. Have your assistant talk to my admin and we'll set something up. When he hung up the phone, Dear V was all he could think about. He left the office without meeting anyone else's gaze, mortified in a way that somehow precluded talking to his colleagues. Had any of them read the book? And stepped out onto 23rd Street. He wanted to track down Dear V immediately. Surely he knew someone who could get him a copy, but there wasn't time before his meeting. He was conducting a 360-degree assessment at a water systems consulting firm by Grand Central Station. Over the past several years, these assessments had become his specialty. At the center of each stood an executive whom the client company hoped to improve, referred to without irony as the target. Clark's current targets included a salesman who made millions for the company but yelled at his subordinates, an obviously brilliant lawyer who worked until 3 a.m. but somehow couldn't meet her deadlines, a public relations executive whose skill in handling clients was matched only by his utter ineptitude at managing his staff. Each of Clark's assessments involved interviewing a dozen or so people who worked in close proximity to the target, presenting the target with a series of reports consisting of anonymized interview comments, positive comments first to soften the blow of the takedowns, and then, in the project's final phase, a few months of coaching. 23rd Street wasn't busy, a little early for the lunch crowd, but he kept getting trapped behind iPhone zombies, people half his age who wandered in a dream with their eyes fixed on their screens. He jostled two of them on purpose, walking faster than usual, upset in a fundamental way that made him feel like punching walls, like running full speed, like throwing himself across a dance floor, although he hadn't done that in 2 decades. When Arthur danced, he'd had a way of flailing just on the edge of the beat. A young woman stopped abruptly at the top of the subway stairs, and he almost crashed into her, glared as he brushed past. She didn't notice, enraptured by her screen, and he stepped aboard a train just before the doors closed, the day's first small moment of grace. He stewed all the way to Grand Central Station, where he took the stairs two at a time to a marble corridor just off the main concourse, passed briefly through the spiced air of Grand Central Market, and down a connecting passage to the Gray Bar building. "I'm sorry I'm late," he said to his interviewee, who shrugged and gestured him into the visitor's chair. "If you think 2 minutes counts as late, we're not going to get along very well." Was that a Texas accent? Dahlia was in her late 30s or early 40s, with a sharp-edged haircut and red-framed glasses that matched her lipstick. Clark went into the usual introduction and preamble about the 360-degree they were doing, her boss as the target. The way he was interviewing 15 people and it would all be anonymous. Comments split off and categorized into separate reports for subordinates, peers, and superiors, with a minimum of 3 in each group, etc. He listened to his voice from a distance and was pleased to note that it sounded steady. "So the point," she said, "if I'm understanding correctly, is to change my boss?" "Well, to address areas of potential weakness," Clark said, thinking of Dear V again as he said this, because isn't indiscretion the very definition of weakness? "To change him," she insisted with a smile. "I suppose you could see it that way." She nodded. "I don't believe in the perfectibility of the individual," she said. "Ah," he said. The thought that crossed his mind was that she looked a little old to be talking like a philosophy undergrad. "How about the improvement of the individual, then?"
"I don't know."
She leaned back in her chair, arms folded, considering the question. Her tone was light, but he was beginning to realize there was nothing flippant about her. He was remembering some of the offhand comments her colleagues had made about her in previous interviews, when his questions had come around to the team. Someone had called her a little different. Someone else, he remembered, had used the word intense. You've been doing this for a while, you said?
21 years.
These people you coach, do they ever actually change? I mean, in any kind of lasting, notable way?
He hesitated. This was actually something he'd wondered about.
They change their behaviors, he said, some of them. Often people will simply have no idea that they are perceived as needing improvement in a certain area, but then they see the report.
She nodded.
You differentiate between changing people and changing behaviors, then?
Of course.
Here's the thing, Dahlia said. I'll bet you can coach Dan, and probably he'll exhibit a turnaround of sorts. He'll improve in concrete areas, but he'll still be a joyless bastard.
No, wait, don't write that down. Let me rephrase that.
Okay, let's say he'll change a little, probably, if you coach him, but he'll still be a successful but unhappy person who works until 9 p.m. every night because he's got a terrible marriage and doesn't want to go home. And don't ask how I know that. Everyone knows when you've got a terrible marriage. It's like having bad breath. You get close enough to a person and it's obvious. And, you know, I'm reaching here, but I'm talking about someone who just seems like he wishes he'd done something different with his life. I mean, really, actually, almost anything. Is this too much?
No, please, go on.
Okay, I love my job, and I'm not just saying that because my boss is going to see my interview comments, which, by the way, I don't believe he won't be able to tell who said what, anonymous or not. But anyway, I look around sometimes, and I think, this will maybe sound weird, it's like the corporate world's full of ghosts. And actually, let me revise that. My parents are in academia, so I've had front row seats for that horror show. I know academia's no different. So maybe a fairer way of putting this would be to say that adulthood's full of ghosts.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I quite...
I'm talking about these people who've ended up in one life instead of another, and they are just so disappointed. Do you know what I mean? They've done what's expected of them. They want to do something different, but it's impossible now. There's a mortgage, kids, whatever. They're trapped.
Dan's like that.
You don't think he likes his job, then?
Correct, she said.
But I don't think he even realizes it. You probably encounter people like him all the time. High-functioning sleepwalkers, essentially.
What was it in this statement that made Clark want to weep?
He was nodding, taking down as much as he could.
Do you think he'd describe himself as unhappy in his work?
No, Dahlia said, because I think people like him think work is supposed to be drudgery, punctuated by very occasional moments of happiness. But when I say happiness, I mostly mean distraction. You know what I mean?
No, please elaborate.
Okay, say you go into the break room, she said, and a couple of people you like are there. Say someone's telling a funny story. You laugh a little. You feel included. Everyone's so funny. You go back to your desk with a sort of, I don't know, I guess afterglow would be the word. You go back to your desk with an afterglow, but then by 4 or 5 o'clock, the day's just turned into yet another day, and you go on like that, looking forward to 5 o'clock, and then the weekend, and then your 2 or 3 annual weeks of paid vacation time, day in, day out, and that's what happens to your life.
Right, Clark said. He was filled in that moment with an inexpressible longing. The previous day he'd gone into the break room and spent 5 minutes laughing at a colleague's impression of a Daily Show bit.
That's what passes for a life, I should say. That's what passes for happiness for most people.
Guys like Dan, they're like sleepwalkers, she said, and nothing ever jolts them awake.
He got through the rest of the interview, shook her hand, walked out through the vaulted lobby of the Gray Bar building to Lexington Avenue. The air was cold, but he longed to be outside, away from other people. He took a long and circuitous route, veering 2 avenues east to the relative quiet of 2nd Avenue. He was thinking of the book, and thinking of what Dahlia had said about sleepwalking, and a strange thought came to him. Had Arthur seen that Clark was sleepwalking? Would this be in the letters to V? Because he had been sleepwalking, Clark realized, moving half asleep through the motions of his life for a while now, years. Not specifically unhappy, but when had he last found real joy in his work? When was the last time he'd been truly moved by anything? When had he last felt awe or inspiration? He wished he could somehow go back and find the iPhone people whom he'd jostled on the sidewalk earlier, apologize to them. "I'm sorry, I've just realized that I'm as minimally present in this world as you are. I had no right to judge." And also he wanted to call every target of every 360-degree report and apologize to them too. Because it's an awful thing to appear in someone else's report. He saw that now. It's an awful thing to be the target. Part 5. Toronto. Chapter 27. There was a moment on Earth, improbable in retrospect, and actually briefer than a moment in the span of human history, more like the blink of an eye, when it was possible to make a living solely by photographing and interviewing famous people. 7 years before the end of the world, Jeevan Chaudhry booked an interview with Arthur Leander. Jeevan had been working as a paparazzo for some years and had made a passable living at it, but he was sick to death of stalking celebrities from behind sidewalk planters and lying in wait in parked cars, so he was trying to become an entertainment journalist, which he felt was sleazy, but less sleazy than his current profession. "I know this guy," he told an editor who'd bought a few of his photos in the past, when the subject of Arthur Leander came up over drinks. "I've seen all his movies, some of them twice. I've stalked him all over town. I've photographed his wives. I can get him to talk to me." The editor agreed to give him a shot. So, on the appointed day, Jeevan drove to a hotel and presented his ID and credentials to a young publicist stationed outside a penthouse suite. "You have 15 minutes, she said, and ushered him in. The suite was all parquet floors and bright lighting. There was a room with canapes on a table and a number of journalists staring at their phones, another room with Arthur in it. The man whom Jeevan believed to be the finest actor of his generation sat in an armchair by a window that looked out over downtown Los Angeles. Jeevan, who had an eye for expensive things, registered the weight of the drapes, the armchair's sleek fabric, the cut of Arthur's suit. There was no reason, Jeevan kept telling himself, why Arthur would know that Jeevan was the one who'd taken the photograph of Miranda. But of course there was. All he could think of was how stupid he'd been to tell Miranda his name that night. The whole entertainment journalist idea had been a mistake, it was obvious now. As he crossed the parquet floor, he entertained wild thoughts of faking a sudden illness and fleeing before Arthur looked up. But Arthur smiled and extended a hand when the publicist introduced them. Jeevan's name seemingly meant nothing to Arthur, and his face, apparently, didn't register either. Jeevan had taken pains to alter his appearance. He'd shaved off the sideburns, he'd taken out his contact lenses and was wearing glasses that he hoped made him look serious. He sat in the armchair across from Arthur and set his recorder on the coffee table between them. He had re-watched all of Arthur's movies over the previous 2 days and had done substantial additional research. But Arthur didn't want to talk about the movie he was shooting, or his training or influences, or what drove him as an artist, or whether he still saw himself as an outsider, as he'd said in one of his first interviews some years back. He responded in monosyllables to Jeevan's first 3 questions. He seemed dazed and hungover. He looked like he hadn't slept well in some time. "So, tell me," he said, after what seemed to Jeevan to be an uncomfortably long silence. His publicist had deposited an emergency cappuccino into his hands a moment earlier. "How does a person become an entertainment journalist?" "Is this one of those postmodern things?" Jeevan asked, "where you turn the tables and interview me? Like those celebrities who take photos of the paparazzi." Careful, he thought. His disappointment at Arthur's disinterest in talking to him was curdling into hostility, and beneath that lurked a number of larger questions of the kind that kept him up at night. Interviewing actors was better than stalking them, but what kind of a journalism career was this? What kind of life? Some people managed to do things that actually mattered. Some people, His brother Frank, for example, were currently covering the war in Afghanistan for Reuters. Jeevan didn't specifically want to be Frank, but he couldn't help but feel that he'd made a number of wrong turns in comparison.
I don't know, Arthur said. I'm just curious. How'd you get into this line of work?
Gradually, and then suddenly. The actor frowned as if trying to remember something.
Gradually and then suddenly, he repeated.
He was quiet for a moment.
No, seriously, he said, snapping out of it. I've always wondered what drives you people.
Money, generally speaking.
Sure, but aren't there easier jobs? This whole entertainment journalism thing. I mean, look, I'm not saying a guy like you is the same as the paparazzi.
Thank you for paying so little attention, Jeevan thought.
I know what you do isn't the same as what they do, but I've seen guys...
Arthur held up a hand, hold that thought, and swallowed half his cappuccino. The infusion of caffeine made his eyes widen slightly.
I've seen guys climb trees, he said. I'm not kidding. This was during my divorce, around the time Miranda moved out. I'm washing the dishes, I look out the window, and there's this guy balancing up there with a camera.
You wash dishes?
Yeah, the housekeeper was talking to the press, so I fired her, and then the dishwasher broke.
Never rains but it pours, right?
Arthur grinned.
I like you, he said.
Jeevan smiled, embarrassed by how flattered he was by this.
It's an interesting line of work, he said. One meets some interesting people.
One also meets some of the most boring people on the face of the earth, but he thought a little flattery couldn't hurt.
I've always been interested in people, Arthur said. What drives them, what moves them, that kind of thing.
Jeevan searched his face for some kind of sarcasm, but he seemed utterly sincere.
Me too, actually.
I'm just asking, Arthur said, because you don't seem like most of the others.
I don't?
Really?
I mean, did you always want to be an entertainment guy?
I used to be a photographer.
What kind of photography?
Arthur was finishing his cappuccino.
Weddings and portraits?
And you went from that to writing about people like me?
Yes, Jeevan said. I did.
Why would you?
I was sick of going to weddings. The pay was better. It was less of a hassle.
Why do you ask?
Arthur reached across the table and turned off Jeevan's tape recorder.
Do you know how tired I am of talking about myself?
You do give a lot of interviews.
Too many.
Don't write that I said that.
It was easier when it was just theater and TV work, the occasional profile or feature or interview or whatever, but you get successful in movies, and Christ, it's like this whole other thing.
He raised his cup in a cappuccino signaling motion, and Jeevan heard the publicist's heels clicking away on the floor behind him.
Sorry, he said. I know it's a little disingenuous to complain about a job like mine.
You have no idea, Jeevan thought. You're rich, and you'll always be rich, and if you wanted to, you could stop working today and never work again.
But you've been doing movies for years, he said in his most neutral tone.
Yeah, Arthur said. I guess I'm still not used to it. It's still somehow embarrassing, all the attention. I tell people I don't notice the paparazzi anymore, but I do. I just can't look at them.
Which I appreciate, Jeevan thought. He was aware that his 15-minute allotment was trickling away.
He held up the recorder so Arthur would notice it, pressed the record button, and set it on the coffee table between them.
You've had considerable success, Jeevan said, and with that comes, of course, a certain loss of privacy. Is it fair to say that you find the scrutiny difficult?
Arthur sighed. He clasped his hands together, and Jeevan had an impression that he was gathering his strength.
You know, Arthur said clearly and brightly, playing a new devil-may-care individual who wouldn't sound in the playback like he was pale and obviously sleep-deprived with dark circles under his eyes. I just figure that's part of the deal, you know? We're so lucky to be in this position, all of us who make our living as actors, and I find complaints about invasion of privacy to be disingenuous, frankly. I mean, let's be real here. We wanted to be famous, right? It isn't like we didn't know what we'd be facing going in.
The speech seemed to take something out of him. He wilted visibly and accepted a new cappuccino from his publicist with a nod of thanks. An awkward silence ensued.
So you just flew in from Chicago, Jeevan said, at a loss.
Yes, I did. Arthur reached and turned off Jeevan's recorder again.
Tell me something, he said. What did you say your name was?
Jeevan Chaudhry.
If I tell you something, Jeevan Chaudhry, how long do I have before it appears in print?
Well, Jeevan said, what do you want to tell me?
Something no one else knows, but I want 24 hours before it appears anywhere.
Arthur, the publicist said from somewhere behind Jeevan, we live in the information age. It'll be on TMZ before he gets to the parking lot.
I'm a man of my word, Jeevan said. At that point in his directionless life, he wasn't sure if this was true or not, but it was nice to think that it might be.
What does that mean? Arthur asked.
It means I do what I say I'm going to do.
Okay, look, Arthur said. If I tell you something, guaranteed exclusive?
Yes, I'll tell no one else, on condition that you give me 24 hours.
Fine, Jeevan said. I could give you 24 hours until it runs.
Not just until it runs. 24 hours until you tell another living soul, because I don't want some intern at wherever the hell you work leaking it themselves.
Okay, Jeevan said. 24 hours before I tell another living soul.
He was pleased by the intrigue.
Arthur, the publicist said, could I speak with you for a moment?
No, Arthur said, I have to do this.
You don't have to do anything, she said. Remember who you're talking to.
I'm a man of my word, Jeevan repeated.
This sounded a little sillier the second time.
You're a journalist, she said. Don't be ridiculous, Arthur.
Okay, look, Arthur said to Jeevan. I came here directly from the airport.
Okay.
I came here 2 hours early, almost 3 hours, actually, because I didn't want to go home first.
Why didn't...
I'm leaving my wife for Lydia Marks, Arthur said.
Oh, my God, the publicist said.
Lydia Marks was Arthur's co-star on the film that had just wrapped in Chicago. Jeevan had photographed her coming out of a club once in Los Angeles, bright-eyed and almost supernaturally put together at 3 in the morning. She was the sort of person who liked the paparazzi, and sometimes actually called them in advance. She had flashed him a winning smile.
You're leaving Elizabeth Colton? Jeevan said.
Why?
Because I have to. I'm in love with someone else.
Why are you telling me this?
I'm moving in with Lydia next month, he said, and Elizabeth doesn't know yet. I flew here a week ago when I had the day off from filming, specifically to tell her, and I just couldn't do it.
Look, here's what you have to understand about Elizabeth. Nothing bad has ever happened to her.
Nothing?
Don't write that in your piece. I shouldn't have mentioned it. The point is, I haven't been able to tell her. I couldn't do it any of the times we spoke on the phone, and I couldn't do it today. But if you tell me that this story will appear tomorrow, then that forces my hand, doesn't it?
It'll be a sensitive story, Jeevan said. You and Elizabeth are still friends, and you wish only the best for her. You have no further comment, and you desire for her privacy to be respected at this difficult time. That about it?
Arthur sighed. He looked somewhat older than 44.
Can you say it was mutual, for her sake?
The split was mutual and, amicable, Jeevan said. You and Elizabeth remain friends. You have considerable respect for one another and have decided, mutually, that it's best for you to go your separate ways. And you wish for privacy in this, I don't know, in this difficult time?
That's perfect.
Do you want me to mention the...
Jeevan didn't finish the sentence, but he didn't have to.
Arthur winced and looked at the ceiling.
Yes, he said in a strained voice. Let's mention the baby. Why not?
Your first priority is your son, Tyler, who you and Elizabeth are committed to co-parenting.
I'll make it less awkward than that.
Thank you, Arthur said.
Chapter 28 Arthur thanked him,
And then what? On his brother's sofa in a tower on the south edge of Toronto, 8 days after Arthur's death, Jeevan stared at the ceiling and tried to remember how it had played out. Had the publicist offered him a cappuccino? No, she had not, although that would have been nice. Jeevan had been thinking of cappuccinos a great deal, because cappuccinos were among his favorite things, and it had occurred to him that if everything was as bad as the television news suggested, he might never drink another. The things we fixate on, he thought. Anyway, the publicist. She'd escorted him out without looking at him and closed the door in his face. And somehow this was already 7 years ago. Jeevan lay on the sofa, entertaining flashes of random memory and thinking of things like cappuccinos and beer, while Frank worked on his latest ghostwriting project, a memoir of a philanthropist whose name he was contractually forbidden from mentioning. Jeevan kept thinking of his girlfriend, his house in Cabbage Town, wondering if he was going to see either of them again. Cell phones had stopped working by then. His brother had no landline. Outside, the world was ending, and snow continued to fall. Chapter 29. He'd kept his word, though. This was one of the very few moments Jeevan was proud of in his professional life. He had told no one about Arthur and Elizabeth's split, absolutely no one, for a full 24 hours after the interview. "What are you smiling about?" Frank asked. "Arthur Leander." In a different lifetime, Jeevan had stood outside Arthur's house by the hour, smoking cigarettes and staring up at the windows, dazed with boredom. One night he'd tricked Arthur's first wife into an unflattering photograph, and he'd made good money on the shot, but he still felt bad about it. The way she'd looked at him, stunned and sad, with the cigarette in her hand, hair sticking up in all directions, the strap of her dress falling off her shoulder. Strange to think of it now, in this winter city. Chapter 30.
"You've got to stop singing that song," Frank said.
"Sorry, but it's the perfect song."
"I don't disagree, but you've got a terrible singing voice."
It was the end of the world as they knew it. Jeevan had had that song stuck in his head for several days now, ever since he'd appeared on his brother's doorstep with the shopping carts. For a while they'd lived in front of the television news, low volume, a murmured litany of nightmares that left them drained and reeling, drifting in and out of sleep. How could so many die so quickly? The numbers seemed impossible. Jeevan taped plastic over all of the air ducts in the apartment and wondered if this was enough, if the virus could still reach them either through or perhaps somehow around the edges of the tape. He rigged Frank's bath towels over the windows to prevent stray light from escaping at night, and pushed Frank's dresser in front of the door. People knocked sometimes, and when they did, Jeevan and Frank fell silent. They were afraid of everyone who wasn't them. Twice someone tried to break in, scratching around the lock with some metal tool, while Frank and Jeevan waited in an agony of stillness. But the deadbolt held. Days slipped past, and the news went on and on until it began to seem abstract, a horror movie that wouldn't end. The newscasters had a numb, flattened way of speaking. They sometimes wept. Frank's living room was on the corner of the building, with views of both the city and the lake. Jeevan preferred the view of the lake. If he turned Frank's telescope toward the city, he saw the expressway, which was upsetting. Traffic had inched along for the first 2 days, pulling trailers, plastic bins, and suitcases strapped to roofs. But by the third morning, the gridlock was absolute, and people had started walking between the cars with their suitcases, their children and dogs. By day 5, Frank was working on his ghostwriting project instead of watching the news, because he said the news was going to drive them both crazy, and by then most of the newscasters weren't even newscasters, just people who worked for the network and were seemingly unused to being on the other side of the camera, cameramen and administrators speaking haltingly into the lens. and then countries began to go dark, city by city. No news out of Moscow, then no news out of Beijing, then Sydney, London, Paris, etc. Social media bristling with hysterical rumors, and the local news became more and more local. Stations dropping away one by one, until finally the last channel on air showed only a single shot in a newsroom. Station employees taking turns standing before the camera and disseminating whatever information they had. And then one night, Jeevan opened his eyes at 2 a.m. and the newsroom was empty. Everyone had left. He stared at the empty room on the screen for a long time. The other channels were all static and test patterns by then, except for the ones that were repeating a government emergency broadcast over and over, useless advice about staying indoors and avoiding crowded places. A day later, someone finally switched off the camera on the empty newsroom, or the camera died on its own. The day after that, the internet blinked out. Toronto was falling silent. Every morning the quiet was deeper, the perpetual hum of the city fading away. Jeevan mentioned this to Frank, who said, "Everyone's running out of gas." The thing was, Jeevan realized, looking at the stopped cars on the highway, even the people who hadn't run out of gas couldn't go anywhere now. All the roads would be blocked by abandoned cars. Frank never stopped working. The philanthropist's memoir was almost complete. "He's probably dead," Jeevan said. "Probably," Frank agreed. "Why are you still writing about him?"
"I signed a contract."
"But everyone else who signed the contract..."
"I know,"
Frank said. Jeevan was holding his useless cell phone up to the window. A no service available message flashed on the screen. He let the phone fall to the sofa and stared out at the lake. Maybe a boat would come, and... On silent afternoons in his brother's apartment, Jeevan found himself thinking about how human the city is, how human everything is. We bemoaned the impersonality of the modern world, but that was a lie, it seemed to him. It had never been impersonal at all. There had always been a massive, delicate infrastructure of people, all of them working unnoticed around us. And when people stop going to work, the entire operation grinds to a halt. No one delivers fuel to the gas stations or the airports. Cars are stranded. Airplanes cannot fly. Trucks remain at their points of origin. Food never reaches the cities. Grocery stores close. Businesses are locked and then looted. No one comes to work at the power plants or the substations. No one removes fallen trees from electrical lines. Jeevan was standing by the window when the lights went out. There was a stupid moment or two when he stood near the front door, flipping the light switches. On, off, on, off.
"Stop it," Frank said.
He was taking notes in a margin of his manuscript in the gray light that seeped through the blinds.
"You're driving me crazy."
Frank was hiding in his project, Jeevan had realized, but he couldn't begrudge Frank the strategy. If Jeevan had had a project, he'd have hidden it too. "It could just be us," Jeevan said. "Maybe just a blown fuse in the basement?"
"Of course it isn't just us. The only remarkable thing is that the lights stayed on as long as they did."
"It's like the treehouse," Frank said. This was sometime around day 30, a few days after the end of running water. Whole days passed when they didn't speak, but there were inexplicable moments of peace. Jeevan had never felt so close to his brother. Frank worked on the philanthropist's memoir, and Jeevan read. He spent hours studying the lake through the telescope, but the sky and the water were empty. No planes, no ships. And where was the internet? He hadn't thought of the treehouse in a long time. It had been in the backyard of their childhood home in the Toronto suburbs, and they'd stayed up there for hours at a time with comic books. There was a rope ladder that could be pulled up to thwart would-be invaders. "We can wait this out for quite a while," Jeevan said. He was surveying the water supply, which was still reasonable. He'd filled every receptacle in the apartment with water before it stopped coming out of the taps, and more recently he'd been catching snow in pots and bowls on the balcony.
Yes, Frank said. But then what?
Well, we'll just stay here till the lights come back on, or the Red Cross shows up, or whatever.
Jeevan had been prone to cinematic daydreams lately, images tumbling together and overlapping, and his favorite movie involved waking in the morning to the sound of a loudspeaker, the army coming in and announcing that it was all over, this whole flu thing cleared up and taken care of, everything back to normal again. He'd push the dresser away from the door and go down to the parking lot. Maybe a soldier would offer him a cup of coffee, clap him on the back. He imagined people congratulating him on his foresight in stocking up on food.
What makes you think the lights will come back on? Frank asked without looking up.
Jeevan started to reply, but words failed him.
Chapter 31 Interview of Kirsten Raymond by François Diallo, librarian of the New Petoskey Library and publisher of the New Petoskey News, Year 15, continued.
Diallo. Forgive me, I shouldn't have asked about the knife tattoos.
Raymond. Forgiven.
Diallo. Thank you. I wondered, though, if I might ask you about the collapse?
Raymond. Sure.
Diallo. You were in Toronto, I think. Were you with your parents?
Raymond.
No, that last night, day one in Toronto, or I guess it's night one, isn't it? Whatever you want to call it. I was in a production of King Lear, and the lead actor died on stage. His name was Arthur Leander. You remember, we talked about this a few years ago, and you had his obituary in one of your newspapers.
Diallo. But perhaps you wouldn't mind for the benefit of our newspaper's readers.
Raymond. Okay, yes. He had a heart attack on stage, like I was saying. I don't remember many details about him because I don't remember very much about anything from that time. But I've retained a sort of impression of him, if that makes sense. I know he was kind to me and that we had some sort of friendship, and I remember very clearly the night when he died. I was on stage with two other girls in the production, and I was behind Arthur, so I didn't see his face. But I remember there was some commotion just in front of the stage, and then I remember hearing a sound, this sharp thwack, and that was Arthur hitting his hand on the plywood pillar by my head. He'd sort of stumbled back, his arm flailed out, and then a man from the audience had climbed up on the stage and was running toward him.
Diallo, the mystery audience member who knew CPR. He's in the New York Times obituary.
Raymond. He was kind to me. Do you know his name?
Diallo. I'm not sure anyone does.
Chapter 32 On day 47, Jeevan saw smoke rising in the distance. He didn't imagine the fire would get very far, given all the snow. But the thought of fires in a city without firefighters hadn't occurred to him.
Jeevan sometimes heard gunshots at night. Neither rolled-up towels nor plastic nor duct tape could keep the stench from the hallway from seeping in, so they kept the windows open at all times and wore layers of clothes. They slept close together on Frank's bed for warmth.
Eventually, we're going to have to leave. Jeevan said.
Frank put his pen down and looked past Jeevan at the window, at the lake and the cold blue sky.
I don't know where I'd go, he said. I don't know how I'd do it.
Jeevan stretched out on the sofa and closed his eyes. Decisions would have to be made soon. There was enough food for only another 2 weeks. When Jeevan looked out at the expressway, the thought that plagued him was that maneuvering Frank's wheelchair through that crush of stopped cars would be impossible. They'd have to take alternate roads, but what if all of the roads were like this? They hadn't heard anyone in the corridor for over a week, so that night Jeevan decided to risk venturing out of the apartment. He pushed the dresser away from the door and took the stairs to the roof.
After all these weeks indoors, he felt exposed in the cold air. Moonlight glinted on glass, but there was no other light. A stark and unexpected beauty. Silent metropolis. No movement. Out over the lake, the stars were vanishing, blinking out one by one behind a bank of cloud. He smelled snow in the air. They would leave, he decided, and use the storm as cover.
But what would be out there? Frank asked. I'm not an idiot, Jeevan. I hear the gunshots. I saw the news reports before the stations went dark.
I don't know, a town somewhere? A farm?
A farm? Are you a farmer?
Even if it weren't the middle of winter, Jeevan, do farms even work without electricity and irrigation systems? What do you think will grow in the spring? What will you eat there in the meantime?
I don't know, Frank. Do you know how to hunt?
Of course not. I've never fired a gun.
Can you fish?
Stop it, Jeevan said.
After I was shot, when they told me I wouldn't walk again, and I was lying in the hospital, I spent a lot of time thinking about civilization, what it means and what I value in it. I remember thinking that I never wanted to see a war zone again as long as I live. I still don't.
There's still a world out there, Jeevan said, outside this apartment.
I think there's just survival out there, Jeevan. I think you should go out there and try to survive.
I can't just leave you.
I'll leave first, Frank said. I've given this some thought.
What do you mean? He asked. But he knew what Frank meant.
Chapter 33. Raymond.
Do you still have that obituary of Arthur Leander? I remember you showed it to me years ago, but I don't remember if it had the name...
Diallo. Do I still have the second-to-last edition of the New York Times?
What a question. Of course I do.
But no, it doesn't have the name. That man from the audience who performed CPR on Leander, he's unidentified. Under normal circumstances, there would have been a follow-up story, presumably. Someone would have found him, tracked him down. But tell me what happened. Mr. Leander fell, and then...
Raymond. Yes, he collapsed, and then a man came running across the stage, and I realized he'd come from the audience. He was trying to save Arthur. He was performing CPR. And then the medics arrived, and the man from the audience sat with me while they did their work. I remember the curtain fell, and I was sitting there on stage watching the medics, and the man from the audience spoke with me. He was so calm. That's what I remember about him. We went and sat in the wings for a while until my minder found us. She was a babysitter, I guess. It was her job to look after me and the other two children in the show.
Diallo. Do you remember her name?
Raymond. No. I remember she was crying, really sobbing, and it made me cry, too. She cleaned my makeup off, and then she gave me a present, that glass paperweight I showed you once.
Diallo.
You're still the only person I know who carries a paperweight in her backpack.
Raymond. It's not that heavy.
Diallo.
It seems an unusual gift for a child.
Raymond. I know, but I thought it was beautiful. I still think it's beautiful.
Diallo.
That's why you took it with you when you left Toronto?
Raymond.
Yes. Anyway, she gave it to me, and I guess eventually we quieted down. I remember after that we stayed in the dressing room playing cards, and then she kept calling my parents, but they never came.
Diallo.
Did they call her back?
Raymond. She couldn't reach them. I should say I don't really remember this next part, but my brother told me. Eventually, she called Peter, my brother, who was at home that night. He said he didn't know where they were either, but said she could bring me home and he'd look after me. Peter was much older than me, 15 or 16 at the time, so he looked after me a lot. The woman drove me home and left me there with him.
Diallo.
And your parents?
Raymond. I never saw them again. I have friends with similar stories. People just vanished.
Diallo.
They were among the very first then, if this was day one in Toronto.
Raymond. Yes, they must have been. I wonder sometimes what happened to them. I think perhaps they got sick in their offices and went to the ER. That seems to me the most likely scenario. And then once they got there, well, I can't imagine how anyone could have survived in any of the hospitals.
Diallo. So you stayed at home with your brother and waited for them to come back?
Raymond. We didn't know what was happening. For the first little while, waiting seemed to make sense.
Chapter 34.
Read me something, Jeevan said on the 58th day. He was lying on the sofa, staring up at the ceiling, and he'd been drifting in and out of sleep. It was the first thing he'd said in 2 days. Frank cleared his throat.
Anything in particular?
He hadn't spoken in 2 days either.
The page you're working on now.
Really?
You want some overprivileged philanthropist's thoughts on the charity work of Hollywood actors?
Why not?
Frank cleared his throat.
The immortal words of a philanthropist whose name I'm not allowed to divulge, but who you've never heard of anyway, he said. What I like to see is when actors use their celebrity in an interesting way. Some of them have charitable foundations. They do things like try to bring attention to the plight of women and girls in Afghanistan, or they're trying to save the white African rhino, or they discover a passion for adult literacy or what have you. All worthy causes, of course, and I know their fame helps to get the word out. But let's be honest here. None of them went into the entertainment industry because they wanted to do good in the world. Speaking for myself, I didn't even think about charity until I was already successful. Before they were famous, my actor friends were just going to auditions and struggling to be noticed, taking any work they could find, acting for free in friends' movies, working in restaurants or as caterers, just trying to get by. They acted because they loved acting. But also, let's be honest here, to be noticed. All they wanted was to be seen. I've been thinking lately about immortality, what it means to be remembered, what I want to be remembered for, certain questions concerning memory and fame. I love watching old movies. I watch the faces of long-dead actors on the screen, and I think about how they'll never truly die. I know that's a cliché, but it happens to be true. Not just the famous ones who everyone knows, the Clark Gables, the Ava Gardners, but the bit players, the maid carrying the tray, the butler, the cowboys in the bar, the third girl from the left in the nightclub. They're all immortal to me. First, we only want to be seen. But once we're seen, that's not enough anymore. After that, we want to be remembered.
Chapter 35.
Diallo, what was it like those last days before you left Toronto?
Raymond, I stayed in the basement watching television. The neighborhood was emptying out. Peter was going out at night, stealing food, I think. And then one morning he said, Kiki, we've got to go. He hot-wired a car that the neighbors had abandoned, and we drove for a while, but we got trapped. All the ramps onto the expressway were clogged with abandoned cars, the side roads, too. Finally, we just had to walk, like everyone else.
Diallo. Where did you go?
Raymond. East and south, around the lake and down into the United States. The border was open by then. All the guards had left.
Diallo. Did you have a set destination?
Raymond. I don't think so. No. But it was either leave or wait in Toronto. And what would we have been waiting for?
Chapter 36. Jeevan resolved to follow the lake. The beach was all gravel and rocks, difficult to walk on in the snow, in the twilight. He was afraid of twisting his ankle, and he didn't like the footprints he was leaving. But he was determined to stay off the roads if he possibly could. He wanted very much to avoid other people. On his last evening in the apartment, he'd stood by the window, watching the expressway through the telescope. In 3 hours of watching, he had seen only 2 people, both headed away from downtown, furtive,
glancing over their shoulders. In every moment of those hours, he was aware of the silence emanating from Frank's bedroom. He'd checked twice to make sure Frank wasn't breathing, knew the second time was irrational, but how terrible would it be for Frank to wake up alone? He'd felt a vertiginous giving way, the cliff crumbling beneath his feet, but held to sanity by sheer willpower. He wasn't well, but was anyone? While he was waiting for the day to end, he sat at Frank's desk, looking out at the lake, trying to hold on to the tranquility of these last few moments, here in this apartment where he'd been for so long. Frank had left his manuscript on the desk. Jeevan found the page he'd been working on, a philanthropist's thoughts on old movies and fame, Frank's impeccable handwriting in the top margin. "I've been thinking lately about immortality." Was that line Frank's, then, not the philanthropist's? Impossible to say. Jeevan folded the piece of paper and put it in his pocket. Just after sunset, he left the apartment with a dusty backpack that Frank had taken on hiking trips in his pre-spinal cord injury days. Its existence was something of a mystery. Had Frank imagined he'd someday walk again? Was he planning on giving it to someone? When the last light was fading over the lake, Jeevan pushed the dresser aside, stepped out into the terrible corridor with its reek of death and garbage, and made his way down the stairs in darkness. He stood for several minutes behind the door that led to the lobby, listening, before he eased it open and slipped through, heart pounding. The lobby was deserted, but the glass doors had been smashed. The world had emptied out since he'd last seen it. There was no movement on the plaza or on the street or on the distant expressway, a smell of smoke in the air with a chemical tinge that spoke of burning offices and house fires. But most striking was the absolute absence of electric light. Once, in his early 20s, he'd been walking up Yonge Street around 11 p.m., and every light on the street had blinked out. For an instant, the city had vanished around him, and then the lights were back so quickly that it was like a hallucination, everyone on the street asking their companions if they'd seen it too. Was it just me? And at the time, he'd been chilled by the suggestion of a dark city. It was as frightening as he would have imagined. He wanted only to escape. The moon was a crescent in the evening sky. He walked as quietly as possible, the pack weighing on him with every step. He avoided the roads as much as he could. The lake to his left, black water gleaming. The beach was pale in the half-light. Impossible not to think of Frank, lying still on the bed with an empty bottle of sleeping pills on the nightstand, but he couldn't dwell on Frank, because every sound might mean the end of everything. Every shadow could be hiding someone with a gun who wanted his backpack. He felt his senses sharpening, an absolute focus taking hold. This is what it would take. There was something out on the lake, a white shape bobbing. A sailboat, he decided, probably the same one he'd seen weeks ago from the apartment. Probably no one aboard. He kept walking, and the city kept pulling him away from the lake. He climbed embankments and followed lakeside streets until he could return to the water, until finally the city fell away. Every so often he stopped to listen, but heard only the water on the gravel beach, a gentle wind. After some hours he heard gunshots, far distant. Two quick, sharp noises, and then the light closed over the sounds, and there was only Jeevan, only the water, only whatever frightened souls still remained. He wished he could move faster. The moon was setting. He was passing along the edge of an industrial wasteland. It occurred to him that he was very tired, and also that it would be dangerous to fall asleep. He somehow hadn't thought much about what it would be like to sleep out here, unprotected. He was cold. He could no longer feel his toes, or his tongue either, because he'd been putting snow in his mouth to stay hydrated. He placed a pinch of snow on his tongue and thought of making snow ice cream with Frank and their mother when they were small boys. First, you stir in the vanilla. Frank, standing on a stool on his wondrously functional pre-Libya legs, the bullet that would sever his spinal cord still 25 years away but already approaching. A woman giving birth to a child who will someday pull the trigger on a gun. a designer sketching the weapon or its precursor, a dictator making a decision that will spark in the fullness of time into the conflagration that Frank will go overseas to cover for Roy.